Bill O'Reilly, thank you. One of the most successful communicators in the history of the planet, on television, on the internet, and in books. The newest book, the most recent, Killing Crazy Horse, The Merciless Indian Wars in America. This morning, it's number 4 on the New York Times bestseller list. Bill, thanks so much. Is it accurate to say you're the best-selling nonfiction author in history?
That is accurate, Kelly. Isn't that amazing? I'm glad it's an Irish guy.
Who's number 2?
I guess Woodward. I guess Woodward would be number 2. Maybe there are some people in the 19th century that we don't know about, but in modern times, I'm number 1. I would probably say Bob Woodward would be number 2.
You know, I don't know if I see him as a historian in the sense that you are. I mean, you go into, you know, decades past, centuries past, and he is always about, you know, stuff that happened 4 months ago, it seems like.
Yeah, I mean, look, the Killing series are 9 of them now, and you were kind enough to point out that Killing Crazy Horse number 4 today on the New York Times list after 10 weeks in the marketplace. There's a demand for these books because people want to know the truth about their country historically. So we have 9 of them out, 18 million copies in print, if you can believe that. That's just stunning. First book was Killing Lincoln, and then we chronicled all the way up to the present day in, actually World War II. I haven't gone, but my next book will be, and we're going to announce that book in about 10 days, will be kind of a modern history of this country. So when I was a young guy, I was a history teacher, and I always loved it. And I brought the same techniques to keep the urchins awake in history class because they had no interest at all until I kind of brought them a new way to look at it. And then we brought that over to the books, and it's worked fantastically.
So I obviously want to talk to you about the election, about Donald Trump, who you've known for decades, and you've written some really compelling content for BillO'Reilly.com. I obviously want to get to all that, but I do want to spend a couple of minutes talking about some things that I know and don't know about you, actually, and you've written about. You just alluded to one of them. You were a teacher. Your first job after college, I believe, you were a history teacher, as you just said. How 2 years, and did you ever see yourself as a career educator? Was that the plan?
No, it was a holding pattern. I graduated in 1971, and the Vietnam War was winding down. The lottery had come in. And so we were all looking around to see what we were going to do and how the country was going to go forward. And I went to Marist College in Poughkeepsie, New York. They had a relationship with a number of Catholic schools around the world where they would hire very cheap labor, and that's for sure, to go down and teach the urchins. And so a couple of us decided on Miami. We thought, oh, Miami, that's going to be great. Unfortunately, the school was in Opa-locka, the crack capital of the world. Not a nice place at all. But I was, you know, looking back, that was the best thing that could ever have happened to me, teaching in a ghetto school, even though it was a Catholic school. It was a rough place. And but I never wanted to make it a career. I didn't know what I wanted to do when I got out of college, but I knew that I had been blessed with the ability to speak and the ability to write. I've never taken a writing course in my life. I've never taken a speech course. I was just gifted with that from God, and every human being has gifts, which is why I believe in God. If there were no God, there'd be a few of us just walking into walls, you know, Kelly? But everybody has gifts. So I decided after 2 years that that was enough. I'd go back and get a master's at Boston University, where my mother actually attended. And I got a broadcast journalism major, master's. That was in the height of the Watergate, and that's what motivated me.
Were you able to, did you go on a scholarship or anything like that?
No, are you kidding? I paid every cent.
And back then, you could actually work your way. I mean, you could, it wasn't ridiculously expensive.
I paid it, you know, I wasn't able to save a lot of money teaching because they were paying us nothing. But in the summer, I painted houses on Long Island, and I had my own company. And I made tons of money painting houses. And that's how I put myself through BU.
A lot of people say it's optional, you know, getting a master's degree in journalism. I mean, it's good. It's not necessary. Did you get a lot out of it?
What I got out of it was this. I was on the school newspaper, the Daily Free Press, still operating to this day at Boston U. Because I had a little press card, I could run around the whole town and cover anything I wanted to cover. Huge advantage for me. And I file every week. I write two or three articles a week, and that was tremendous. The rest of it was blather. The professors up there didn't know anything. There was one guy who did, Lord, it was his name, and John Lord, and he was excellent. But you don't need a master's degree to succeed in journalism in this country. You need ethics and honesty, and they're in short supply these days, as we know.
Interesting that you went to BU. Howard Stern went to Boston University.
I was there when he was there.
Did you know him?
Yeah, I didn't know him like there's Howard Stern. I knew him because we were both in the School of Public Communication, SPC, and he was the only guy in the school taller than me. And there was this guy kind of lurking down the hallway with this shoulder-length hair. And so everybody knew, there's Howard. But no, I didn't have anything to do with him, but we were in the hallway at the same time.
And you grew up only a few miles apart in Nassau County. And I always wondered the proximity to New York City. A lot of great broadcasters have come from Long Island. And do you think that had anything to do, you know, like Malcolm Gladwell talked about that kind of happenstance? And, you know, if you grew up somewhere else, you would not be doing what you're doing today?
I don't think Long Island had anything to do with me being a journalist. What it had to do with was a sensibility that I still have to this day, that my job is to report to the folks who live in Levittown, where I was raised. It's not to do with the suits the corporate people want me to do. That separated me early and often from the pack. Now, I got into trouble throughout my career with that attitude, but I never ever deviated from it. And ultimately, my success was based upon people believing that I was telling them the truth because I wanted them to have better lives and more information. And that's absolutely 100% true, which is why I've succeeded everywhere I've been, everywhere. And because I went through the BS, and there's plenty of that in broadcasting, and I went right to the folks, and they appreciated it. And so this, the Levittown sensibility that I got there and held was responsible for my success.
Now, when you say management, and that put you at odds with management, they had their own version of how things should be done in terms of storytelling, or how did you, I mean, look, anybody who's good in broadcasting does run afoul of management from time to time. So what was that like? How did you get in trouble?
Well, when I was working my way up, I was a hotshot, you know, very flamboyant, always kicking down doors, getting the story no matter how I had to get it. And that alienated a lot of people. And some stations were okay with it, and some stations were not. So the stations that were not, I had to leave. And so in my first few years, I went from Scranton, Pennsylvania, good, Dallas, not so good, Denver, good until the news director got fired and then a bad news director came in. Hartford, not so good. WCBS, Channel 2 in New York, good. So it depended upon what the management, how they saw the world and their business. If you wanted conformity, you didn't want me because I wasn't going to do that. So when I went to CBS News after I succeeded at Channel 2, they wanted conformity. They wanted, you know, to Bigfoot, and that means take stories that you report, give them to the people who weren't on the scene. And I was in nasty places, like El Salvador and Argentina during the Falklands War. You know, I mean, I wasn't out running around Rhode Island. And I hated it. So I left CBS very quickly. But then, later on, a couple of years later, I went to ABC. And I worked for Jennings, and Jennings was a good boss to me, all right? And I prospered under him, and I became friends with him. And so it's just a matter of where you are and what the demands on you are. When I went to Fox, I really liked working for Roger Ailes. I mean, he was a no BS guy. If he says something, then it would happen. Most of the executives are so insecure and they don't have any skill set they're just there because they kiss butt and stuff like that, or their father owns a company. But if you get a guy like Ailes who really knew what talent was, knew how to present, I mean, I just prospered. And he left me alone. And then the rest is history, 20-plus years there. But if you would try to intrude and say, no, Riley, you're going to report it this way, it was over. I wasn't going to do that.
Were you ever frustrated, as I have been, quite frankly, in my career? I was in the Marine Corps, and, you know, I'm an officer. I'm in charge of stuff and equipment. But when you become a reporter, you're not really in charge. You can't hire people. You generally can't fire people. You know, you're responsible for your story and your content. But, you know, you're constantly, even though you're college educated and you're advancing in years, you know, you don't have executive authority. At least I never did, or for the most part. Did that, maybe you did, but if you didn't, did that frustrate you?
Not really. I was never interested in that. I just wanted to do good work in a unique way, and the unique part got me in trouble. So when I anchored the local news in Portland, Oregon, and Hartford, Connecticut, I anchored it differently. I gave it a much, much harder edge. And, you know, they made money. People came and watched, but they didn't like it because they were getting phone calls. But then I went to the CVB in Boston, Channel 5 in Boston, and they hired me for my edge. And then I got real successful. So it was, I never cared about running the operation or telling other people what to do. I had no interest in that at all. But at Fox, I had to have autonomy over the O'Reilly factor. I wasn't a dictator, but I couldn't have corporate interference on a program. I mean, I wrote it all. I laid it out, and my staff responded to my instructions, not the company's instructions. So Ailes allowed me to do that and made billions with a B over that period of time because he made that judgment. Very few people had the authority I had, but I had it. And we had discussions about it. I said, look, I got to run this as a maverick operation that's so different that everybody's going to watch, which is exactly what happened.
By the way, real quick on Scranton, when you were there, your first TV job, was there an awareness of Joe Biden? I guess he had just been elected when you were there.
No.
None, right?
No. I mean, it was a guy named Flood, a real corrupt congressman. That was the guy everybody was talking about. But that was a great, you know, look, I didn't want to go to Scranton. I didn't have any money. I got out of BU with the master's. I didn't have enough money to put gas in my car to drive up there. I had to borrow $20. That's how broke I was, and I didn't want to go there. But I knew that, you know, if I put in a little time in a little market in northeastern Pennsylvania, that, you know, I would do well. I was always confident. And that's what happened. I was there 9 months, and then I got catapulted into Dallas, which was a top 10 market. I made a huge leap. And I did it because the people, the good people, the Shelburne family, owned the station in Scranton. Let me do what I do. They didn't constrain me. And, you know, it caught on fast.
Was there a moment in your career where it's like, okay, you always had confidence and you were succeeding, but where your success became like really tangible to the outside world? You know, whether, you know, when you started making $1 million a year or whatever it was, where there was a moment you're like, okay, this is kind of a game changer. I'm a big deal.
That was Inside Edition. Still on the air today. So they hired me as the primary correspondent for Inside Edition. David Frost was the anchor man. Big syndicated show, lots of money behind it. All right, so it clears, and this was supposed to be competing with A Current Affair. You might remember that program. So I sign on, and I left ABC News to job. And Jennings, I remember him yelling at me, why are you doing this? You're crazy. I have a good career here at ABC. And I said, they're doubling my salary. And in my contract, Peter, I can cover any story in the world I want to cover. I had that written into my contract. Any story in the world, I could go. And I did. I was in the Berlin Wall. I was in Australia. I was in Thailand. You name it. Vietnam. So anyway, when I went over to Inside Edition, the show fell apart in 3 weeks because David Frost couldn't do it. I'm not going to tell you why he couldn't do it, but there was a reason he couldn't do it. And it was a disaster. And we got canceled on Channel 4 in New York. We were in Access, 7 o'clock. They canceled this. All hell breaking loose. So the producers of Inside Edition came to me and said, look, we want to take you, want you to take over from Frost. This is after 3 weeks, if you can imagine. All right, and everybody's panicking because everybody had left good jobs to come there. And you'll be the interim anchor. I said, all right, but here's the deal. I have to write the show, and you're not going to tell me what I can and can't say. They agreed. We turned it around into another hundreds of million dollar franchise. When I turned that around, and it wasn't just me. I mean, there were a lot of very talented reporters there. But I was able to put it on in a way that working class people understood it and enjoyed it. And we turned it around pretty fast. Then I knew. Right then, I knew. And you know who else knew? Roger Ailes. He was working at CNBC, and he saw that. And that's why I got hired at the Fox News Channel.
Wow. Can I ask you real quick about Peter Jennings? You mentioned you were friends. I never met Peter Jennings, but I did watch him. Max Robinson was in Chicago, and he was in London, and then Frank Reynolds, and then he was the guy. I've kind of been curious about him for a long time. He didn't go to college, as you know, and I think he was pretty tall. I guess my question is, I heard that ABC was a snake pit, a tough place to work, and Peter had his favorites. You know, he was particularly in awe of Ivy Leaguers, but he also held them in contempt. And, you know, if you were short, either he didn't like you or he liked you because he wasn't threatened by you. Did those personal factors, whether you want to talk about Peter or anywhere else, like, aren't those weird things that should have nothing to do with the job and should have nothing to do with the workplace kind of often unstated reasons why people succeed and or fail?
All right, well, let's walk through it. So I never pay attention to office politics ever. It wasn't my thing. Peter Jennings was the son of the president of the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. He didn't need to go to college. There are three broadcasters in my lifetime, four broadcasters in my lifetime that were just beyond the pale, off the charts skilled. First one is Mike Wallace. Second one is Tom Snyder. Third one is Howard Cosell. And the fourth one is Peter Jennings. These guys had a skill set that was just phenomenal. And I latched on to that in the sense that I watched everything they did because I recognized how good they were. So when I went to ABC, it was a snake pit. They all are, and they remain so this today. If you're going to work at network news or cable news, these are nasty places where there's no fairness, and there are people trying to kill other people for sport. That's what they do. I went in, and I basically said to Rune Arledge, who was the architect of Monday Night Football, and then he was running ABC News, don't mess with me. Don't hire me if you're going to mess with me. All right? I looked him in the eye, and I don't think he's ever had an interview applicant say that. But I was working in Boston. I was a big star there, and I didn't want to come back into some kind of insane situation that I had experienced at ABC News. All right. I'm sorry, at CBS News. I didn't want to duplicate my CBS experience at ABC. So he said, no, you can do your reporting. And I said, I don't even want a producer to come with me on my stories. This is a true story. If you're a network correspondent, usually you have a producer coming with you on the shoot because most network correspondents can't write. They can't do anything. You have to give them the script, tell them what questions to ask. People think I'm exaggerating. It's absolutely true. I said, I don't want a producer because the producer, you know, could undermine me, could lie about me. That's what they do at CBS, and I don't want it. So I traveled alone. I was one of the few solo guys. All hell would break loose. I'd go out. I'd bring it back. Now, Jennings came to admire that. I don't know why. I don't kiss anybody's butt. You've known me long enough to know that. I never do that. All right, but he came to admire the skill set that I brought, that I could cover things fast, that I could go live on the air without throwing up. And, you know, he kind of mentored me. Now, is he a tough guy? Yes. If you looked at him cross-eyed and he didn't like you, then you were through. All that existed, but I didn't pay attention to any of it. Rather, it was the same way. All right. I don't know Brokaw very well, but I hear he was the same way. These guys get up there. They know how hard it is. They know everybody wants their job and blah, 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 blah. So anyway, I said, spent 2 years at ABC, and then I took the chance to go over to Inside Edition. And then after 6 years at Inside Edition, I had had enough of that, that kind of infotainment. And I went up to Harvard and got a master's degree in public policy at the Kennedy School. And then I came back and Alice hired me for Fox.
By the way, the public policy degree, that's a 2-year degree, isn't it?
It's a year and a half for me. It was public administration.
Okay.
It was the mid-career program.
Yeah.
And I think Harvard had had enough of me, so they would have shortened it anyway. but I had a great time in Cambridge, much different place then than it is now.
Now, my father went to the mid-career program at the Kennedy School for MPA, and he loved it. I visited him then when I was in ninth grade. Wait, you said the four top performers in broadcasting, Mike Wallace, Tom Snyder, Peter Jennings. Who was the other?
Tom Snyder.
No, Tom Snyder, Mike Wallace, Peter Jennings. Was there one other?
Howard Cosell.
Oh, Howard Cosell. One thing you said, and I'm very curious about this dilemma that you're sometimes in, or anybody who succeeds but wants to keep connection to the folks. I mean, today, or maybe it was yesterday, you tweeted about Sean Connery, you know, that he died, and you passed on your condolences. And a little anecdote, you had dinner with him at one point, and you know and have access to all of these people of crazy success levels and accomplishment. Yet you have maintained this deep connection with the folks, as you put it. And I just wonder, do you get to a point where you could be seduced permanently by the fame and the fortune and all of that and say goodbye to the people? I think a lot of folks do that, and then they're always imitating or thinking back to what it would be like to be a person rather than being a person. Does that make sense? And have you ever had to struggle?
Yeah, look,
that?
I mean, here's a decision you have to make if you succeed in America. It doesn't matter whether it's broadcasting or business or wherever it may be. If you succeed, you're going to have access to a lot of things that most people don't have access to. So I, very early on, made a decision never to work for money. All right, and I've turned down, I mean, I can't tell you. Right now I run BillO'Reilly.com. I'm the CEO, and it's exploded in the last year because of COVID and politics. So now my website is worth millions, tens of millions of dollars. But it didn't, when I started it, when I left Fox and started it, it wasn't. But I had a lot of offers when I left Fox, big money offers to go places and do things. But they weren't, in my opinion, they weren't right. I could feel it. And then I always thought back on, hey, O'Reilly, you don't work for money. You do the things that you believe are worthy. I made a decision very early and in my career that I was not going to sell out. So one of the good things about being successful is you, as I just said, have access. So I have access to pretty much every famous person in the world. And there are some people that I wanted to meet. And that's how I got, I actually did Sean Connery a favor when he was at the U.S. Tennis matches in Flushing. I'm not going to get into the story, but I helped him out. And he was a big Factor fan before that. He used to watch in Nassau, the Bahamas, where he lived every night. He was hysterical. He'd call me up and go, "Oh, lighting is pretty bad, Factor." You know, guy, I know, Mr. Connery. But I have met pretty much every human being on earth that I wanted to meet. And I, you know, I had a list. I want to meet these people. Jack Nicholson, Clint Eastwood, you know, all, I mean, you go down the line, all the sports guys. I just talked to Joe Namath 2 days ago. I love him. And I grew up, he was my idol because I was a football player. And now I'm friends with him. I can't even believe I'm friends with him.
I want to talk about
but,
no, go ahead. Keep going. Sorry.
So anyway, I was able to put together a resume of people that I wanted to speak to, that I wanted to learn about their lives and what they did and how they did it. And that Connery was in that crew. And I was able to do it. And he was, I can't tell you what a funny, Great dinner we had sitting there, and his stories were fantastic. I brought my son because my son's an actor, and I, you know, he was telling him, you know, this is what you have to do. I was just like a fairy tale. And that's one of the things that, you know, has made my life so entertaining for me. I have an entertaining life. I mean, a lot of bad things like everybody else. But I never thought when I was at high school that any of this would ever happen. None of my people ever succeeded. My ancestors never got out of the working class. So anyway, I feel I'm a lucky guy.
When was the I love that, by the way. There must have been a time where you're doing whether it's Inside Edition or The Factor, and you find out that some stupendously famous and successful person is a fan and just in the content. Was there
a
moment?
I can't tell you. Yeah, I can't tell you how many people. My assistant, Makita, has been with me for 29 years, and she would buzz me in the office or at home here and say, Cher is on the line. And I go, Cher who? You know, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
I can't tell you how many hundreds of famous people have called me over the years with a beef or a request or a question or whatever, you know. So it's very entertaining to me, and I'm respectful to almost everyone. I can't remember anyone I wouldn't talk to. Even if I didn't like them, I'd give them a shot, you know. And it's really been an educational experience that I don't think many people have had.
When did you first meet Donald Trump, the very first meeting? Do you remember?
30 years ago, I was at Inside Edition, and he was running around with Marla Maples. I chronicle his story in the history book I wrote on Trump, The United States of Trump, which, if you're interested in Trump, is the best book I think ever written on him. And I met him because I was covering that story, as we all had to in New York, but I hated it. I didn't care about Marla Maples and Donald Trump. I mean, so what? But anyway, I covered it differently, as I always do, and he noticed that. And so he called me a couple of times. We had some conversations and this, that, and the other thing. And then he called me one time and said, look, I need you to do me a favor. And I said, depends what it is, Mr. Trump. He goes, I need you to go on a double date because Marla's college roommate's in town. And I went, what? And I write about it. It's hysterical. That's in The United States of Trump, the double date with Donald Trump. And that was, what, 30 years ago?
You went to a Knicks game, didn't you? What was
no,
the,
we went to
movies? New Jersey.
Paula Abdul concert, if you can believe this. Paula
yeah.
Abdul.
Yeah,
oh, my God.
Forever your girl.
And she was very nice, I have to say. She was very nice. But I'm looking at my watch going, how much longer is this going to go on?
That's wild. That's totally wild. All right. So he's a friend. You socialize with him. I would imagine. I mean, you weren't close. You just kind of socialized.
No, I wasn't his buddy. I don't run in that crew. He would want to. He's a big sports guy, as am I. And, you know, if he wanted to go to a game or something, he'd call me up and say, hey, I got court sides or I got front row at Yankee Stadium. And I said, sure, when are we going? Why not? Why wouldn't I? And so we go to games, and he was an unbelievably fascinating guy. He knew everybody. And that helped me as a journalist because I could say, what about this guy? What about that guy? And he'd tell the truth. He wouldn't, you know, blank it off. I said, look, I'm not quoting you, but just tell me the, you know, real deal on these people. So I learned, I got so much from him going to these games, and it was amusing, it was funny. And he was all right. I mean, you know, I'm not running around to his casinos and all that. I'm not one of those guys that do that. But he was okay, and we struck up an acquaintanceship.
He was different back then, wasn't he? He was a bit more polished. You watch interviews with him, his vocabulary is different. It's more sophisticated. I think it was a conscious shift, but is that a fair observation on my part?
I really haven't seen that, Greg. I haven't seen a big shift in his persona. Always self-absorbed, always a guy who wanted a lot. But I didn't, you know, I wasn't analyzing the guy. As long as he was honest and entertaining, and, you know, that was it. But when he ran for president, I never thought he would. And I told him, I said, you're not going to win. I mean, come on. These guys are going to roll you. They got the establishment on their side. You're coming at it. But, man, I'll tell you what, he is very shrewd. The way he used the media, the way he did it, how he went in, and very, very smart and shrewd.
When did you
much smarter than me.
When did you realize, when did you start to take him seriously? When is this, okay, this is real. This is not just a stunt.
Well, I always took him seriously because it would be disrespectful to anybody if I didn't do that.
Well, I mean, not seriously, seriously, but like when you look, you said he's going to lose. I mean, you can't do this.
Yeah, I didn't think he had the juice. I didn't think he had the juice to get the Republican Party nomination. When he got the nomination, I knew he could beat Hillary, and I predicted 5 days out that he would win. But I didn't think he could get the nomination. I didn't think he could beat the Bush machine. But I did more interviews with him than anybody in the primaries and leading up, and then in the election 2016. I mean, we were, you know, I was the go-to show. Now Hannity is. But my interviews with him were very different than the interviews that he's done this time around. Very, very different.
You pushed him.
Always. Because that's what I do. I was respectful to him, and I write about the Megyn Kelly situation in the United States of Trump and how that got out of control, but you could have done the same thing a different way, and that's what I do. I interviewed Obama 3 times. Biden would never interview with me. He knows me. But he always laughed when I called. He goes, I'm not going on with you, you know, that kind of thing. So he was smart enough to know he wouldn't be able to hold his own with me. But I interviewed 7 presidents. I mean, I've done it, and I know how to do it. And it's the hardest interview you could ever do.
Well, you make it look easy. It's pretty incredible. Although they always mischaracterize it, I've noticed. I think you asked... There was some CNN media reporter who said, in response to your question, Trump said something and you were slack-jawed. You couldn't believe his answer. And I watched it, and that's obviously not what happened. You know what I mean? You were just taking it all in stride. Stuff like that all the time bothers me. So, all right, you wrote about it on BillO'Reilly.com, your outlook for the election. I think it dropped yesterday, the story, or possibly the day before. One thing overall, I'd like your sense of where we are and where we're going. But before we do that, just Joe Biden, you mentioned you believe he's corrupt. I happen to believe the same thing. I also think it's total outright corruption that the media are not pursuing the Hunter hard drive story and a million other stories about Joe Biden. But tell us about Joe Biden's corruption as you see it.
Well, there's no doubt he did what U.S. Grant did. And I mean, I know that sounds pin-heavy, but I'm a historian. And this is the way I process things. So I don't know whether Joe Biden took any money from his son's ventures overseas. That has not been established. But there's no doubt that he helped his brother, his son, and other family members make a lot of money overseas for doing pretty much nothing. There's no doubt about that. So the media, it took them 11 days to figure out their story. Now they have it. They just put it out yesterday. We tried to verify what was on the hard drive, but they wouldn't give us access. That's NBC's new thing now. What a bunch of crap. I mean, it really is. They never tried to verify anything. They were ordered to shoot the story down, tear the story up, not find out what really happened. So what really happened was, as Vice President, Joe Biden allowed his son access to Air Force Two to fly certain places. Now, if you're a dad and your son wants to go, I don't have any problem. But if your son comes back with $5 million, I might have a problem. Okay, I'm going to put it down so everybody can understand it. So Biden uses his VP status to enrich his son and his brother and other members of the family. That's corrupt. That's what U.S. Grant did. There was actually a saying in the 1870s, Grantism. It was used by the newspapers, and that meant that you were being a fraud and allowing your family members to enrich themselves. That was called Grantism. And Grant suffered a lot because of what he did, and he did it. Grant did it. So I'm going to myself, well, why isn't Biden being held to the same standard as U.S. Grant? Because the press hates Trump. They don't care if Biden's corrupt. They just want Trump gone, and that's what we're looking at.
Will there be a moment if Trump wins, and I believe he will, the media will be forced to reevaluate everything, all of their procedures, their practices, just everything that has not worked out for them?
Well, what I would do, and I'm not in this game, but if I were a Republican running a political action committee or a watchdog group and Trump wins on Tuesday, I would sue the polling outfits for fraud. I would bring them in and do discovery on them and tear them to pieces, because every poll has Trump losing dramatically that the networks buy. CNN poll, NBC, ABC, CBS, everyone. Trump's going to get his butt kicked. If that doesn't happen, you can sue them. You can bring them in to civil court, and I would. Now, we'll see if anybody's listening to this podcast and they go, oh. But right now, when I see these polls roll in, I don't believe a word of them. However, I think Biden will win the popular vote by a significant margin because of California. And if Trump doesn't win Pennsylvania, Biden could win the election.
This is how you sum up your weekly column on BillO'Reilly.com. Coming back to Donald Trump, if he wins re-election, he'll continue to do what he does, the tweeting, the feuding, the quest for never-ending approval. But he will not hurt you, your children, your grandchildren. Biden, Harris, Sanders, Pelosi, Schumer, etc. will. They want to impose a new America where centralized federal power dictates your behavior right down to what you can say and how much you're allowed to have. They will try to alter the Supreme Court in an attempt to make this happen. Think very hard about your voting decision. Danger is close. Powerful stuff, Bill. Well done.
Thank you. It's absolutely 100% true. Now, if the Republicans can hold the Senate, they'll blunt some of that. But if they lose across the board, all our lives are going to change for the worse.
You know America well. You're so in touch with this country, this president, the whole scene. What do you think is going to happen on Tuesday?
Well, I think that it's going to be competitive. So those who think it's going to be a landslide one way or the other, I heard Newt Gingrich last week go, it's going to be a red wave, a big landslide. I'm going, boy, if that's right, Newt Gingrich gets to be the genius of all time, because I don't see it. So I think Trump will take the states, most of the states he took last time. I think he'll win Florida. I think he'll win Texas. I think he'll win Arizona. And then he'll go up the East Coast to win Georgia, South Carolina, and North Carolina. Puts him in a pretty strong spot. But then in the upper Midwest, where COVID is running wild, and remember, COVID is the difference here. If there were no COVID, Trump would win fairly easily against a very weak candidate, Joe Biden. But in Minnesota and Wisconsin and in Michigan, they're getting hammered with COVID. And women in particular are very afraid of COVID. And when a voter historically is afraid, they say to themselves, maybe we'll give somebody else a chance. That's usually what happens. Now, in this case, with mass media being so corrupt and the folks knowing the corruption, they understand that the network news and CNN, Washington Post, New York Times are corrupt. Everybody's got that. Will they react to that? Will they say, I may not like Trump, but these people are so beyond the pale, I'm going to vote for him just to get back at them. That, if that happens, then Trump will win. But look at Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania is a key.
Final 2 minutes. with that in mind, how corrupt the media are, I'm actually wondering, is it almost like a parlor game complaining about the mainstream media? Because so many people get their news and information from other means, and it's quite frankly inefficient to get information from a television broadcast, you know, sit there for a half hour. You can get it in so many other different ways faster. And, you know, Rush and those guys are so big on the radio and you and your content that it almost doesn't matter. Like railing about CBS, NBC and ABC, as I do a lot, is almost self-serving. It just gives me content, but it doesn't really matter because they're not as much of a force as they used to be.
It's true. They're not as much of a force as they used to be. That's absolutely true. And after the election, no matter who wins, you're going to see an absolute decline of all television news. I mean, audiences are going to flee because they know they're not getting the truth, and why bother, right? So the problem is that you say, well, they get it from other places, and that means they get it from the internet, social media, all of this stuff. All of that information is shaped still by the New York Times, the Washington Post, the networks. They shape it. So they're the ones that basically put out what's important and what isn't. So nobody knows that Donald Trump, for example, signed an executive order to clean up the oceans, all right, which was a tremendous thing to do. Nobody knows it. It's not on social media. It's not anywhere. Because the corporations that control 90% of the national news flow didn't want anybody knowing that because it makes Trump look good, all right? I could give you 30 of those. And that's the danger, is that we're almost in a totalitarian country as far as information flow is concerned. The cancel culture knocks people out that the corporate media fears. And it's hard for those people to recover. That's just unbelievably dangerous. And that will accelerate under a Biden, who's just going to sit in the White House and do, he's not going to stand up to any of this crazy stuff. Bernie Sanders calling the Philadelphia police murderers? Did you hear a word from Joe Biden about that? He's not going to stand up to that. And that's the danger. So, yes, the straight media, the corporate media is diminished, but it still sets the agenda for what people know about. And it's going to take another 5, maybe 10 years for that to disappear. It will. Corporate media is never coming back. They've damaged themselves so much. The ultimate irony is that Donald Trump killed the media. He killed them.
Bill, final 2 minutes. I am very curious about your work practices, your time management. You put out these books, the content. It's never ending. And I'm wondering, though, if you have any kind of tricks or techniques that you live by, you know, structuring your day, morning rituals. I don't know, that allow for this kind of productivity?
Well, I have urchins to take care of. I've got Holly the Terra Dog. You know, it's not all work. It's a lot of other stuff. So we run things like a military operation here, and you can identify with that being an ex-Marine. There's a time for everything in the day, and the time is adhered to. So it's not like it's painful to do it. But it's very well organized. And my staff, and I've got really three staffs. One is TV, one is radio / books, and the other is domestic. Handle a house and all of that. They all know that they have to do certain things at certain times. And, you know, I'm not a martinet. I mean, I give everybody plenty of room. But everything has to be done. So I guess if you boil it down, we don't procrastinate, word of the day, procrastinate. We don't put it off. We get it done. If I'm writing a book, there's a certain amount of words that I have to write every week. We do it. And usually do more, all right? And we never slack off. And I'm blessed with good health. I can sleep at night, so I'm not, you know, exhausted. I got a lot of energy for a guy my age. I tell Trump the only one that's livelier than you is me. And it's true. And I'm happy to do all this. I mean, we want to be a force for good in America. BillO'Reilly.com, I believe, is that. When people go there, you're going to get straight information. It's going to be backed up. We're in business to help you. and the books. I want everybody to read them and learn about their country in a way that means something to their own lives. So that's what we do, and we get it done, Kelly. We get it done.
It's so impressive. It really is, and we're all grateful. We're all benefiting. Killing Crazy Horse, The Merciless Indian Wars in America, again, number 4 on the New York Times bestseller list. Number 1 best-selling nonfiction author in history. Oh, and you mentioned United States of Trump. It is the best book on Trump, apart from Art of the Deal, Trump's own book. If you want to get to know Trump, I actually think that's a good book. But Bill O'Reilly, can't thank you enough. Fascinating talking to you, and continued success. Thank you, sir.
All right, Greg, thanks for having me in. Talk soon.
So grateful to Bill O'Reilly. Check out BillO'Reilly.com. That book is great, all of the books. And wow, the guy really knows this country, knows a lot, and he's and he's an open book. He really is. All right, it's going to be a hell of a week. I have a feeling we're going to know the results on Tuesday night. It'll be apparent that Donald Trump is the victor, although they're going to probably drag it out. Pennsylvania, they'll make a game about it, but we shall see. In the meantime, I'll see you on Newsmax Monday through Friday, 7 p.m. on the East Coast. That's 4 o'clock on the West. And follow me at Greg Kelly USA. And, oh, one other thing, if you don't mind, this could help a lot. Rate and review the podcast. And I'm not sure exactly why, but that's like an important thing. It's free, of course. And all right, all the best, and thanks again.